Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. To listen to Business Movers 1 week early and ad-free, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. It's early 2007 in Chris DeWolf's MySpace office in Beverly Hills, California. Chris is amped up. He has an idea to get MySpace involved in an entirely new space, presidential elections. As Chris excitedly paces the room, Tom leans back in his chair, puts his feet up on Chris's desk.
You really want to get into politics?
Absolutely, Tom. I think it'll be a big win for us.
Haven't you ever heard that you're not supposed to talk about politics or religion with your friends?
That might be true for our parents' generation, but I think our users want to talk about politics.
Chris can tell Tom is still skeptical.
But you hate the idea, don't you?
No, I don't hate it.
Then what's the problem?
I don't know, it feels gross.
A political presence will open up new advertisers and take us one step closer to being a full-scale media outlet.
Tom sighs. He still isn't sure.
Look, man, this is happening with or without us.
And what do you mean by that?
I read an interview where Jen Psaki said MySpace is going to be one of the tools they use in the primaries.
Jen who?
Jen Psaki. She's a spokesperson for Barack Obama. Someone from John Edwards' campaign said something similar, and same with John McCain, Hillary Clinton, Rudy Giuliani. They're all setting up MySpace profiles. We might as well embrace the moment and use it to our advantage. You know, like MTV did. Rock the vote.
At this, Tom perks up. MTV's been working with the Rock the Vote organization since the early 1990s, televising events geared towards connecting presidential candidates with younger voters. Chris and Tom have been pushing to transform MySpace into the MTV of the internet since they launched their MySpace music tool. So Tom is starting to see that this might be his chance to achieve part of that goal.
Well, I mean, if we're going to do this, we need to do it right. MTV didn't just run ads for elections. They made Rock the Vote an entire campaign. There was live events, interviews with candidates, celebrities talking about the election. They encourage people to vote. So if we go this route, we have to go all in, just like MTV.
Chris nods and has an idea what he thinks will be an easy sell to candidates and advertisers.
Well, what if we create a channel on MySpace dedicated to the 2008 election, where the candidates' profile pages are prominently featured?
Anyone can do that, Chris. We need to do something different.
All right.
What if we give the candidates the ability to get donations from users directly on the site?
Tom smiles ear to ear.
Now we're talking. We can fill the page with videos, interviews, blog entries about the candidates so users can get a full picture of everybody who's running. We could even create campaign posters for all the candidates that users can post on their own profiles, like digital yard signs.
Oh, man, this is perfect. And the press will love it.
I think advertisers will, too.
Yeah, and our users should be able to share everything with their friends. The yard signs, the election information, all of it. They need to be able to do it easily and do it fast.
Sounds like you're coming around. You think this is something, Tom?
Yeah, I think this could be big.
In March 2007, MySpace launched the Impact Channel. Candidates from both sides of the aisle took advantage. And as a result, MySpace and other social media sites would be seen as key factors in the 2008 election. Years later, a political journalist would write, "Leading up to the 2008 election, Barack Obama was the first presidential candidate to embrace the power of social media to build his brand. The entire landscape of political campaigning changed through his use of grassroots fundraising, social media expertise, and viral sensibilities used to defeat more prominently known candidates." And with their impact channel, MySpace played an integral role in establishing social media as an effective election tool. But the efforts of MySpace and other social media sites arguably had unintended consequences. MySpace helped to create an online environment in which election-related news stories, videos, and commentary could easily be passed from one user to another. This content could quickly spread across MySpace and other social media sites and find its way onto other websites, whether or not this information was true or false. Social media sites like MySpace created a platform that would help give rise to what is commonly known as fake news.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Long before Instagram, TikTok, or Facebook's metaverse, MySpace co-founders Chris and Tom were pioneers of social media. Though MySpace has largely disappeared from the social media zeitgeist, many of the decisions Chris and Tom made in MySpace's early days made a lasting impact that reverberates still today. There's no doubt social media, coupled with the rise of new technologies like smartphones, have changed the way we live, shop, and communicate. It's changed our culture, our politics, and the way we conduct business. But in many respects, the story of MySpace and of social media in general is one of unintended consequences. The supercomputer in our pockets and the sites and apps we visit on a daily basis play a large role in what our guest today calls the psychology of technology. And here to talk with us about the past, present, and future of the business and psychology of social media is Dr. Laren Rosen, author of the book, The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World. Here's our conversation. Dr. Larry Rosen, thank you for speaking to me on Business Movers.
Thanks for having me.
So MySpace was, in many ways, a pioneer in the world of social media, but it was not the first site of its kind. Other sites, like Friendster, were certainly in the space first. So I'm wondering if you could help us decipher what made MySpace unique.
MySpace was exceptionally unique, first of all, because it was geared toward younger people, whereas Friendster tended to be geared toward more college and above. What MySpace did is they did three things that were very interesting. One is they allowed you to play music, any music you wanted, and to change the music anytime you wanted. It allowed you to create interesting backgrounds and art, but it also allowed you to continually list your top 8, which then they changed to top 16. And so it really appealed to kids who are like that. They're always changing their music, they do art, and they want to list who their best friends are. So it was really attractive. And at one point, it was adding 250,000 people a day.
MySpace in those days have often been likened to perhaps decorating your locker at school. Is that something you would agree with?
That's a great description. I like that. But I would add decorating your locker, only giving your combination to your best friends, and having a radio in your locker.
Of course, all businesses like MySpace, they're there to make a profit. They sell products to people. Social media, though, is unique because in many ways, in most ways, people are the product. Social media companies like MySpace, they sell people's information and attention to advertisers who then deliver targeted ads in the hope that we buy things. But in the case of MySpace, do you think that founders Chris and Tom really saw the potential for where we're at now with Google, Twitter, Facebook?
I don't think so. We saw a little bit of this in the fact that your first friend was Tom, and that Tom always seemed to be around, and that you could comment to Tom or, you know, ask questions to him because he was a friend of yours. But I think what they were aiming for was to have some sort of a strong social platform. I don't think they believed that it could make a lot of money. And particularly when Rupert Murdoch bought it, he was, with all the things he introduced with ads and stuff like that, he was making $50 million a month off of there. I don't think Tom and Chris saw that as a possibility.
So let's investigate this a little more. Now, clearly, Chris in particular was a skilled and experienced marketer and had experience selling products to people. This was his business. And they started MySpace with the aspiration that it would be successful commercially. So where do you think this tension is that started to spring up, where the founders, Chris and Tom, almost deliberately were not making MySpace as commercially viable as perhaps, for instance, Murdoch wanted?
You know, I think that's a very interesting question. And again, we're talking way back here in internet time. But I think one of the things that happened is that as MySpace started to explode, and as they started to get more and more people, I think that the problem became, what do we do with all these people? How do we get this business model to work? And I think they were so overwhelmed by the massive number of people climbing aboard that I don't even think they had time to think about marketing. It was just overwhelming. They had to keep increasing their server sizes. They had to keep being more vigilant in making sure that everything was all right because they didn't want to get under any kind of FCC pressure. And I think the bottom line is that it was really created to be social, and the social part of it just exploded. I was on Friendster when it started. Friendster had a small following and it kind of stayed constant. It wasn't a big draw. Whereas MySpace, again, because it was catering toward younger people, I haven't seen any statistics from the past, but my guess is that well over half the people on MySpace were teenagers or young adults. And I think they had an age of 13 that you had to get on, but of course people lied and said they were 13. So they started building this cadre of people that sort of ranged from preteen to early 20s. And it's hard to market to those people. Those are not the people that buy stuff in general. People that buy stuff are employed people. People have money and time. And these kids were asked to buy things that they would have had to ask their parents to buy it for them. And so I think it just kind of exploded so fast that they had no time to really think through a really good business model. And I think, by the way, that's what they noticed when Rupert Murdoch did it. They must have been chagrined, because he figured out very quickly how to make a business model fit on this platform. And again, that's because he came from a huge business model with lots of businesses that were directed to make money. And I'm sure before he bought it, that he spent time talking to his business partners and his marketers to figure out exactly what they needed to do in order to make a lot of money. So I think that's where it was. It was sort of this schism between a business model and exploding people coming on board and a social model.
Well, talking about the early MySpace business model, this is pre-Murdoch. MySpace stands alone in many of the giants of social media and technology in that it wasn't really well capitalized. It was a shoestring operation. Do you think that affected their culture or their eventual success and failure?
Yeah, I think I do think that it contributed to their success in drawing in lots of people, but their failure in monetizing it. I think that it was a very different environment. And again, they started on a shoestring. They had to keep expanding that. So the money that they were putting out was going to bigger server sizes and all sorts of things to keep the site safe for these kids who are now exploding. And there was also lots of time spent on media by both of them. And they had to explain what they were doing, because this was obviously really new. They had to explain what they were doing, explain how safe it was for everybody over 13. And in the meantime, they're getting these 250,000 a day joining. And so the part of it that was computerized, the electronic part of it, had to really be the primary part in those days. And I think what happened is they just couldn't recover from that in time to figure out how to monetize it.
Well, you know, MySpace had a lot of innovations, but we're circling around a theme in that they were not able to fully capitalize on their commercial potential. Facebook outgrew them. Almost everything outgrew them. MySpace fizzled. In the final analysis, why was that?
I think that the reason that MySpace fizzled is because the people that they would have had to have attracted in order to turn it into a good business didn't like all of the frills, the bells and whistles, the art, the music, the whole thing. And so when Facebook came out, which, by the way, didn't explode as quickly as MySpace at all. When Facebook came out, it was a very stripped down version. It had no music, no art, no nothing. It was basically a stripped down social gathering place. And interestingly enough, almost every social site has basically taken that model and used it in developing theirs and then gone on from there to make money if they can. Although most of the money turns out to go back to Facebook because they own a lot of them. But they have figured out how to make money by stripping it down and attracting the kind of people who are going to spend the money. And that was the difference. I mean, I remember getting on Facebook when it first started because I had a .edu address. And I remember thinking, whoa, this is really minimal. This is this like minimal stuff here. And as I used it, I kind of realized why, because it was so different from MySpace. And MySpace was still increasing at that point when Facebook came out. They were still blowing it out. I think that they were so different. And the feeling I had and the people I work with had was that it was easier. You didn't have to do the music. You didn't have to feel like you had to do the art background. You could just comment. You could just ask questions. You could just do very simple activities with very few keystrokes, which of course fits this very distracted generation that was growing up back then, because they started to be the first generation who had very little ability to focus for very long periods of time. And so I think that was also very attractive, that they just jump in, do something, jump out, and it was no big deal. I think that's the primary reason.
Well, if MySpace was the pioneer and perhaps they overdid it or skewed perhaps too young to be riding the wave of further audience growth and monetization, putting that aside, what is MySpace's legacy in social media?
Oh, I think they have a huge legacy. And I think when we look back in 20 years, we're going to find out that MySpace was so instrumental. And we talk about in the Distracted Mind book that there are really three big game changers in our technological world. One was the World Wide Web, obviously, when it allowed you to click on things and made it just easier to use your environment. And then both sort of at the same time were social media and smartphones. And those two plus the World Wide Web really changed the world. And so MySpace really started that social media track. They were the first one to go, hey, you can do this, and people will flock to it. They didn't say they weren't making any money off of it, but people will flock to it, and then you have an audience. And how that was translated into people's interest in it, then people started to flood onto new platforms, including Facebook, obviously. But we're older. Facebook skewed older immediately. I mean, I think that's partially because they started as a university platform, and they then expanded slowly out of Harvard and into the rest of the world, and slowly added in people. And I think MySpace stood by and watched, but I think in the long run, its legacy is it led to the ability of Facebook to do what they did. It led to Instagram to come back and pull some of that stuff out of MySpace and bring it back, the visual aspects of it. I think MySpace was amazing. I actually wrote a book, I don't remember how many years ago, called Me, MySpace, and I, Parenting the Net Generation. And it was all about how you parent these kids who are on the social media sites. Well, now parenting is much more difficult because the kids are on many social media sites. Millennials average about 6 social media sites that they visit weekly. I think that this all stems from the way MySpace was set up. And I think also MySpace showed that you could explode and still handle those people without problems. And I think that was really important for places like Facebook to be able to feel like they could expand their environment in ways that MySpace did and bring on people, but still create and keep a business model going. And Facebook, by the way, as I remember, did not start with a business model. They started with a social model. And again, that probably stemmed from MySpace as a social model. But then I think as Rupert Murdoch took it over, Facebook went, oh, we can make money out of this. And I think that they then started to follow that model and to this day, obviously, have expanded that model and used it for way more purposes than MySpace ever did.
If you travel for work, you know to pack 2 suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase.
I think it's probably also obvious that one of the other legacies of MySpace is the story of social media's unintended consequences. Chris and Tom, you know, led the charge in making MySpace a free space where users could post whatever they wanted, however they wanted, with little in the way of any rules or regulations. Some users took it too far, criminally so, in some cases. And on the business side, advertisers were also spooked by some of the users' behavior. So I'd like you to investigate the tension between user responsibility and platform responsibility.
Ooh, that's a very interesting question, particularly in the light of what's been going on in the last couple of years. I think that part of what has happened is that both of those have failed. The user responsibility, I think, is the most important one. And I think MySpace, as they struggled to make money and found ways to tailor what you see and the ads you see to information about you that they gleaned, sort of AI work built into this, I think that they focused more on that. And that was kind of the social part leading into the monetary part. And I think that part of what the contribution, again, with MySpace was to their environment is it really helped them populate that and then throw in some AI or simple AI to try to make some money off of it. I remember being on Facebook early on and noting the first ads that showed up and wondering where they came from. And then I'm an observer of people. And watching people play on Facebook, I realized very quickly that what was happening is they were using information that they gleaned from you. And by the way, MySpace, that was one of the contributions, is that they asked for lots of information on you, the about me part and all of the questions, your favorite bands, your favorite this, your favorite that. And then all those quizzes showed up, which cartoon character you most like, which actor you most like. But I think what happened then is that Facebook dove really heavily into that environment and their people and picked up information that allowed them to do some, I think, pretty rudimentary artificial intelligence back then, but it paid off. And so what happened is, I suspect, is that they looked at it and went, how far can we go with this? How can we capture people? And I remember being on one of the platforms at one point, getting off to go to Google and to order some product, and then coming back to Facebook and realizing all the ads had changed. And they all looked like the product that I was thinking about buying, but it was there with competitors. Maybe you should consider this instead. And my wife and I joke about that nowadays they know everything about you. And somehow when you buy something or go to buy something, the ads show up everywhere, which is really good AI, but I think bad personal AI. So I think that we're looking at a trend. And I think that trend is continuing. It's interesting to watch as Facebook and Google kind of swallow up all these companies, that to watch where Apple sits in all this, because Apple doesn't have a social media site, and Apple is really different from Facebook and every other social media site in that they basically have a product that is a phone and an iPad and all sorts of other things. And that's where they make their money. And that's easy. That's the old business model. Facebook and all the other social media sites have to take a different business model to consider how they get their people. And I think they figured it out. It's very effective. Makes me click on those things and buy them.
So yeah, I think that's how the platforms have discovered the value of their users and increasingly honed their effectiveness in the marketplace. But I guess when I was talking about unintended consequences, I kind of meant that suddenly we are exposed to many more people than we ever have been before. Social media has given a megaphone to everyone on the planet, and many of these users are perhaps abusive or irresponsible. And I guess the tension I was wondering about is this user freedom feels democratic, but it also feels abusive. How responsible are the platforms in curtailing bad conduct on their apps?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I'm sorry I didn't get to that before the previous one. But what I think is important to recognize is that Facebook took very seriously the First Amendment, which said you can say what you want to say as long as you don't threaten to kill somebody or do something nefariously bad that's going to land you in prison. And I think that they weren't as vigilant as they could be, because the initial problems that had came from cyberbullying. And that way back when Facebook started, people started recognizing that you could feel safe behind the screen. Nobody would know who you were. You can have an artificial name. Nobody would know anything about you behind the screen because you felt safe. And I mean, when you look at yourself in any screen, what you see is a reflection of you. And so it became kind of a me environment. And when you talk about me environment, you're often talking about narcissistic personality disorder. And that's kind of what started to crop up along with antisocial personality disorder and a few others, a histrionic personality disorder for people who just kept screaming on Facebook about stuff. And in the beginning, I think everybody was kind of taken aback because MySpace was pretty gentle, I think, in the beginning. Actually, MySpace was pretty gentle all the way through its life. But Facebook ended up having to deal with these things as the number of users was exploding at the same time. So unlike MySpace, which was really dealing with the explosion, Facebook was trying to deal with, oh my God, somebody got cyberbullied and killed themselves. What do we do? How do we handle that? What does it mean? Somebody's screaming at somebody else and they're getting very upset. How do we handle that? And I think that they had no good handle on it, because it wasn't something they expected. I mean, yeah, I know that when Facebook started, they also started Hot or Not or something like that, where you would go on and decide who was hot and who was not hot. And that kind of, to me, was at the beginning of the nastiness that you started to see and still see on every platform. And I don't think they handle it well, but I think the problem is they're trying to handle it with algorithms. And yet, much of this is not algorithmically safe. So I think what they started to do a few years ago is hire lots of people to monitor it. And how do you monitor something that's got billions of users and billions of posts every day and billions of comments every day? How do you monitor that? And Twitter's certainly going through that kind of problem. And it's a difficult question to ask from a behavioral scientist point of view. As a behavioral scientist, I was and I'm still appalled at how nasty people can get online. And I know that's sort of this feeling of anonymity. You're behind the screen, you feel safe, you feel like you can say whatever you want, and you do. And the ramifications are very few. I'm still mildly hopeful that they will figure out a way to be better at picking these things up and eliminating them before they cause problems. But I don't have a whole lot of confidence that they'll do a very good job, because again, you're talking about billions of people in billions of languages. How do you do that? So I think that's one of the major issues that's happening.
These companies' abilities to police themselves. I guess the obvious question is, whose responsibility is it then? Is it the social media company's responsibility, period, and they have to correct it? Or is regulation required? Or can other market forces sort it out?
This is where my research comes in, I think, in a very interesting way. One of the things that we do is that we collect screenshots of 7 days worth of screen time on the iOS environment, the iPhone environment. And we look at the 7 days, they collapse into things. And what we find is the most used apps, I'm actually looking at the data right now. The most used apps are TikTok, Instagram, iMessage, YouTube, and other. And the social media parts, or the connection parts, so I can lump iMessage in there, account for 85 to 90%. So you're looking at a very strong environment. And that makes it very difficult. I'm old enough to remember that everybody in the 1950s smoked. For my bar mitzvah, I have had little things of cigarettes on the table, which I think I look back and think it's a little appalling. But doctors smoked. When you saw them in the movies, they were smoking. Everybody was smoking. And then the kind of federal government took the war on cigarettes over and created pretty strong messages. I mean, and I don't know how many of your viewers or listeners rather will remember, but they had one where the Marlboro man, who was the front for Marlboro cigarettes, was all withered and old and smoking a cigarette out of a hole in his neck to show how horrible it was. And then I also kind of glom onto the "This is your brain, this is your brain on drugs" campaign. And both of those came from the top. Both of those were really federally funded warnings. And I mean, obviously, putting messages on cigarette packages certainly helped, although I don't know how much. I think having people sue them had more of an effect. But I think it's going to have to be that kind of a program that's large scale, that says, "This is your brain on social media," or something like that, in order to help people get off their social media addiction. And I really do believe it's a social media addiction, by the way. So addiction, neuroscientifically, biochemically, means that you constantly need more of what you're using in order to get the same amount of pleasure. We often think of that as video games, that you start playing a video game and then you need more and more to get the same amount of pleasure when you started. It's the same with social media. I mean, in social media, you have this issue that you continually need more of it in order to feel as satisfied. And we've been collecting data since the mid-2000s, 2015, 16, on people and finding that this is the truth, that this is the way they do it. And this is this area where I think you can impact most, but it's going to have to be some major program, I'm afraid. As much as I don't really like government intervention in this, I think it's going to have to be some major program that hits everybody with the power of both the cigarette and the drug programs.
Speaking of constantly needing more, it seems like these companies might fall prey to that impulse as well. These companies are large. They're of a scale that is global. In large sense, they're monopolies. Big tech have become targets, the new robber barons of maybe a new gilded age. Now, MySpace didn't survive to become one of these giants. But what do you think the consequences are for businesses, users, society in general, of the concentrated power of companies like Facebook or Twitter?
So what I do in my research and what we do in our lab's research is we do a lot of what I call modeling, which is trying to find out the role of technology in predictive models to predict somebody who, for example, might do poorly in a class, might have sleep problems, might have stress, anxiety, depression. In every model, we start with, can we predict it with two things? Just how anxious you get when your technology is not there or not working right, which is kind of a combination of what they call nomophobia and FOMO. The nomophobia part is not having your phone with you, not being able to connect, out of juice, whatever. The FOMO part is feeling like you're missing out. Both of those fit in the social media environment, obviously. And then the other one is what we call executive dysfunction or executive function, which is how well do you make decisions? How well do you solve problems? How well do you think about these kind of issues? So we try to see, for example, my favorite example is predicting sleep problems. When you're trying to predict sleep problems, what you find is those two directly predict sleep problems. The more dysfunctional your brain is, the more anxiety you feel about technology, the more sleep problems you have. However, they also do another thing that is fascinating. Each of them runs through some technological issues. And there's really two that stand out in all the models. One is social media usage. So those who have more dysfunction in their brain, more problem-solving issues, use social media more, which then enhances their sleep problems, makes them even worse. Same thing for nomophobia or FOMO, that directly impacts your sleep problems, but it also plays through social media. The more anxiety you are, the more social media you use, and the more sleep problems you have. So everything flows through social media first. And then the second one I think is interesting. It's something we call metacognition, which is kind of knowing how you think and knowing what you do. In the realm of academia, for example, if you're looking to predict somebody's performance in a class, it's knowing what you do with your phone when you walk into class. It's knowing whether you put it away, whether you use it. It's knowing how to relate that to a class. In this issue of sleep problems, it's knowing when to put it away at night. It's knowing what to do with it, how to solve your sleep problems and not use it all night long and not have it next to your bed. So in our models, we find that social media plays a major role in this, plays a major role in predicting academic dysfunction, poor grades, more sleep problems, depression, anxiety, stress, all of the above. And it's pretty powerful too. Those are models that you can say make sense and are very powerful models. They're very strongly predictive. So the other issue on this one is that we've also been thinking about including with executive dysfunction and nomophobia, including boredom, which interestingly enough, very few people study out there. I'm fascinated by boredom, mostly by watching how people relate to their phones. When they're bored, they pick up their phone. Boredom turns out to also be a predictor of social media use, and which in turn is a predictor, a strong predictor of anxiety, depression, stress. So all of these combine to enhance the role of social media and make it even worse.
When you choose Organic Valley, not only will you be enjoying great tasting dairy, you'll help to save over 1,600 small organic family farms who are protecting over 400,000 acres of organic farmland and all the plants and animals that call it home. This is dairy you can feel good about. It's great tasting, high quality organic dairy, ethically sourced from small organic family farms. To find Organic Valley Dairy near you, visit ov.coop. That's ov.coop.
You've begun to tell us a little bit of your research here. You're an expert on the psychology of technology and written 7 books on the impact of technology on our world. What is the cutting edge of your research right now?
So there's several areas that we study, and one of them is simply looking at total use of social media. And I started back in 2016 looking at millennials, average age 25, looking at how many times they unlock their phone per day and how many minutes they spent on their phone per day. That back in 2016, basically they were unlocking their phone around 50 times a day, which just seems a lot, and spending about 220 minutes on their phone. Then for millennials, it started increasing dramatically. 2017, it went up to 71 times a day you checked and 260 minutes. And by the time you get to 2020 and you include high school students in here, we're talking about checking your phone 75 to 80 times a day for upwards of 300 minutes. Now, I have to tell you a funny story, because when we started looking at iOS's screen time, we found something very different. It was not that you were unlocking your phone 75 to 80 times a day. You're unlocking it more than 100 times a day. And when you look at the screen time use, it was upwards of 7 hours a day and continuing to increase as we look at more data. The social media time, when you look at those hours spent on social media, hasn't been increasing dramatically over time. And then this holds also for high school students. We started looking at high school students in 2018, 19, 20, and found exactly the same results. So one of the interesting things then asks, what do we do about this? Is there something we can do to help people stop overusing the platform? So we ran an experiment where we gave, I think we started with millennials and high school students at the same time. We gave them a bunch of strategies that they could use to what we called enhance your smartphone experience, but really to decrease it, to move it down a notch. And we gave them a bunch of ones to enhance their communication, to enhance their concentration and focus, to enhance their sleep, and to enhance their general psychological well-being. The first one was the most interesting one, improving communication, because what we asked them to do, if they chose that one, they only had to pick 2 out of the 21 I think we had, was to take each social media icon, put it in a folder, scatter those folders around your home screens and embed some of those folders in other folders so that it would be difficult for you to find your social media icons. Others picked enhancing your well-being. We had them use some sort of meditative app. In your communication, we had them use what we call tech breaks, which is to take time off to look at your tech, but it's just a short time off while you're working on projects or whatever. And getting a good night's sleep had to do with controlling the blue light and also removing your phone an hour before bedtime. So we looked at their daily minutes and their daily unlocks and before, during, and after the experiment. Experiment ran for 3 weeks only. So for millennials, they started with high daily minutes. During the pandemic, they did reduce them, but just a little. And then after the pandemic, they shot right back up immediately. Same thing with daily unlocks. And we find exactly the same pattern for teenagers. In fact, for teenagers, when they were done with the 3 weeks, their post minutes on everything on their smartphone was twice as high as it was before the time. So we ended up going, this is a miserable failure. This didn't work. So we stretched it to 6 weeks and we decided to try it for 6 weeks with another group. And lo and behold, we found exactly the same thing. You really can't change someone's behavior. And I know, at least in this realm, because it's so addictive, it's so obsessive that there's just no way to do something to decrease it, to get it down. Now, people have tried detoxes. People have even created camps up in the mountains where people drop their phones in a bag and leave them there for the entire duration of a weekend or whatever. People have tried detoxes in their home. And none of them work. None of them work because, again, we're talking about a psychological issue. It's an addiction and a compulsion combined together. And if you watch people, by the way, with their phones, they look like they have OCD. Put their phone in the pocket, they take it out immediately. Put their phone in the pocket, take it out immediately. How does that not look like OCD? If their phone's in their pocket, they tap their pocket constantly to make sure it's there. If they feel a tickle or an itch down there, instead of scratching it, they pull their phone out, find out that that was a phantom pocket vibration. So this is sort of where we're at with our research. I talked to lots of groups, parents, business people, young kids even, about this, and it appears right now that there is no way to stop it. And that makes me very sad. There's ways to increase your focus and attention. We know that. And those who have practiced that do very well at changing their habits. And in the distracted mind, we talk about a lot of other things you can do to change your habits that have been shown, the exercise, standing a lot, things like that, biochemically help you. But behaviorally, it's just really hard to change their behavior.
This is a business show, and we try to leave people with lessons they can take away. But this topic, and you as a guest, makes it a bit unusual, because what we have here, and you referenced it earlier, is a product like tobacco that is dangerous. It taps into our physiology. It works on levels we can't control. If social media is impacting our psychology and well-being, then there's no doubt it's impacting us in the workplace, and perhaps impacting our productivity. Is there anything companies or business leaders can do to confront this problem?
There are lots of ways to think about that, and I'm going to take one first. Research has been done extensively in the business world and with millennials and with all sorts of ages on how you focus and attend. There was a study done at University of California, Irvine by Gloria Mark, where they went into businesses for three straight days, 8 hours a day, and wrote down everything that people did. And what they found was people's attention span was about 3 to 6 minutes before they grabbed their phone, before they checked their email, before they got on social media, for whatever. We do the same, by the way, with millennials and even high school students. And it's about 3 to 6 minutes for everybody. So one of the things that I think that workplace can do is to figure out a way to increase those 3 to 6 minutes to a bit more. And one of the ways that we've fashioned this is, as I mentioned earlier, is through tech breaks. And we've done this all over the place, schools, in homes, at dinner table, in the business world, everywhere. And what we find is that if you start by saying, okay, take a look at what you're working on. We want you to focus on what you're working on. So look at your entire screens, whatever you're using, figure out which ones you need for your project and get rid of all the others. Flick them off if it's a phone, close them if it's on a screen, because the problem is if you don't close them, if you just minimize them, they're still there and taunting you to come get them. By the way, we give them 1 minute only to do that. It doesn't take very long. 1 minute, you can shoot off a bunch of text. You can do all this. Give them 1 minute and then set their alarm on their phone for 15 minutes. Turn the sound off, turn it upside down, but put it right in front of you. The reason we have it put right in front of you is because what that does is it tells your brain and your biochemistry, don't worry, don't get anxious. You will get to me, to your screens in 15 minutes or less. And when the 15-minute buzzer goes off, we give them 1 minute, 15 minutes of work, 1 minute, 15 minutes of work, until we find a point where they go, where the alarm goes off and they go, wait, I got to finish concentrating on this. At which point you jack it up and you start going 20 minutes, 25, 30. And I think in the business world, if you can get people to focus for 30 minutes, you're really doing a good job. And I know I've been in a lot of business meetings and I know people keep their phones on the table and they check them all the time. People cannot second screen. They can't multitask and understand what's going on and think deeply. This works in that kind of model. So you have a board meeting or a meeting of your work team, and you do this with their phones. So basically you're giving them permission to check in for a minute. Then you're telling them, turn your phone upside down. So they're not tempted by what they see. This works really well. It works really well at the dinner table. It works really well when you're watching movies with your kids. It works really well when you're playing games, when you're at your kid's soccer practice. It works well everywhere because what you're doing is developing a habit of concentrating for 15, 30 minutes, maybe an hour, if you can get it up that high. I think 30 minutes is pretty good. And what you're doing then is proving to yourself, and you're getting rid of the distractions, because that's what's happening really. You're getting distracted. The 3 to 6 minute focus time is because you're distracted by something. And by the way, you're almost distracted by some sort of technology. It's not like you're distracted by going and getting a glass of water. You're distracted by a notification, which by the way, they get about 160 a day, mostly from social media. So you are distracted. And so we need to eliminate those distractions. Also, part of it is to work with them to look at the notifications, where they're coming from, get rid of many of the notifications that are not critical, and only be notified by things that are really important. That helps cut down on it too.
Well, Dr. Larry Rosen, thank you so much for talking to me today on Business Movers.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
That was my conversation with Dr. Larry Rosen. Larry is a professor emeritus and past chair of the psychology department at California State University, Dominguez Hills. His latest book, The Distracted Mind, Ancient Brains in a High-Tech World, won the 2017 Prose Award for Biomedicine and Neuroscience. From Wondery, this is the final episode in our series on MySpace. On the next season of Business Movers, filmmaker George Lucas builds an empire and turns a niche genre into a billion-dollar industry. Hey, Prime members. You can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about MySpace, we recommend Stealing MySpace by Julia Angwin, The Culture of Connectivity by Jose Van Dyke, and The Rise and Fall of MySpace by Nicholas Jackson and Alexis C. Madrigal for The Atlantic. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is produced by Stephen Walters. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship, Jenny Lauer Beckman, and Marsha Louie for Wondery.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries, and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law and Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.